Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Phoenix, Arizona, it's time for Valley Business Radio, spotlighting the Valley's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Hello and welcome to Valley Business Radio, where we tell stories that the traditional media tends to ignore and help connect you to the right people. I'm your host, Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and I'm joined here in the studio today by Rabbi Michael Bayo from the East Valley Jewish Community Center. Welcome, Rabbi.
Thank you very much for having me.
And we're also joined remotely by Professor Nancy Harowitz, who is a professor of Italian and Jewish studies at Boston University. Thank you for being here, Professor Harowitz.
Thank you so much.
Now, our topic of today's conversation is different than most. Usually on this program, we're focusing on local business leaders, on the work that they do in their companies and organizations, and how they serve the community. But today, we're working that same conversation back from the community side into the lives of the people that you serve. And we're going to talk about the East Valley Jewish Community Center. We're going to talk about the Elie Wiesel and Primo Levi lecture that's coming up. But Rabbi, why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about your organization? Tell us about the East Valley Jewish Community Center and how you're serving folks.
Sure. Thank you very much for having me here and for the opportunity to speak to your audience. The East Valley Jewish Community Center, which is based in Chandler, has been in existence for roughly 40 years. With various reiterations of different names. We have been in our current location for roughly 13 years, and we serve the entire community, irrespective of somebody's religion, faith, background, culture, origins. And geographically, we serve the community from South Phoenix to the west, all the way to the far east of Ahwatukee and Queen Creeks and et cetera, et cetera. Tempe, Gilbert, Mesa, Sun Lake, et cetera. We do about in the range of 800 programs and events a year, serving about 26,000 engagements a year, ranging from movies, theater, education, arts and culture, lectures, exhibits. And that's the reason that we are very lucky and honored that Professor Harowitz will join us in a few weeks for the Elie Wiesel and Primo Levi lecture.
I'm looking forward to hearing some details about that lecture. It's an important topic. I think it touches on many issues that are relevant today. And so we'll unpack that a little bit more. But I really appreciate, I don't know if many people realize, so the scope of what you described, Rabbi Bayo, there in just a very brief minute sounds like a fairly significant operation. 800 programs serving all these different facets of the communities within the area.
Absolutely.
That you serve. Folks might not realize the significance of the community activities that are happening there. Can you talk about some of those specific programs? Give us a sense of, what sorts of things might be bringing in members. Obviously, folks in the Jewish community will know more details because they might be more actively participating. But for people that have never heard of EVJCC before, give a sense of ways they might connect or get involved.
Absolutely. So first of all, we have six different departments within the East Valley JCC. Our first department is the Early Learning Childhood Center. We are a four-star accredited. We take kids, infants from 6 weeks old all the way to pre-K. We currently have about 150 kids. And we are, as I said, NACE accredited, quality first, four stars. And I believe that we are still the only such early childhood center in the entire East Valley that is full time, meaning from 6 in the morning to 6 in the evening. And it's a beautiful, when I get down and on those hard days, I just take a walk through the classrooms and I see those babies and I see those toddlers and kids. And it's an awesome, awesome opportunity to just unload the stress of the day.
You know, one of the things that I understand as an outsider who has interacted with many committed scholars, teachers, religious leaders around the world, is that communities of faith have a primary mission, may or may not be the right word here. You'll correct me and put in the appropriate language here, but a primary mission to serve believers and who are participating in their programs, in their religious services, in the kind of guidance and counseling you provide, etc. But they also play a role in education, in outreach, in building bridges beyond the community of believers with the surrounding community.
Absolutely.
Can you speak to this issue?
Absolutely. So first of all, we have families in our community that, as I said, come from all backgrounds, religious backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, country backgrounds, etc. And when it comes to being really part of the community, we believe very much in common grounds, in finding those bridges that we share. So for example, one of our departments, it's CORE, which is Community Outreach Relationships and Engagements. And this department, we do a lot of interfaith programs. So we bring in religious faith leaders to teach us about their faith, as well as we go out in the community and we participate in a lot of interfaith programs. We have another program called Conversation with the Rabbi, where we invite specific faith leaders to have a conversation with me, just like the one that we're having now. We provide about between 3,000 to 4,000 meals a month, hot meals, to people in need. And when our volunteers go to their homes, that's also an opportunity for those people in need to have a human touch, a human connection. So those are ways that we really try to be part of the community. We do a lot of arts and culture. We bring in really outstanding programs into the Valley, probably very innovative programs into the Valley. And we have awesome relationship with the city of Chandler, where we're based, with faith communities around us. And we're very proud of the work we do.
Now, you moved here to Phoenix from Atlanta.
Yes, sir.
When did you move to the Valley?
4 years ago.
4 years.
Actually, November 15, I believe, will be exactly 4 years.
Wow. I moved here about 6 years ago.
Okay.
It's a place that draws a lot of interesting, diverse viewpoints from other places. And prior to Atlanta, where you were chief development officer for Hillel of Georgia, you were the university chaplain and campus rabbi at Boston University.
Exactly. And that is where I met and I had the pleasure of working together with Professor Horowitz. I was also the executive director of the Hillel House at Boston University. It was a great opportunity, great experience. And that is where the Hillel partnered on many programs with the Elie Wiesel Center for Jewish Studies. And that's how we got to work together, both with Professor Horowitz and with Professor Michael Zanka, the director of the center. And so when I moved down here, it was natural for me, as part of our Center for Holocaust Education and Human Dignity, to reach out to Professor Zanka and Nancy and say, guys, can we create a partnership? And they were very open to that opportunity, to that idea. We, I believe, are the only organization outside of Boston that has created this kind of partnership. And this is going to be the first time that the Elie Wiesel Lecture will be starting now, and hopefully will be a yearly opportunity to take professors away from the cold of Boston to the awesome weather of Arizona.
the 330 days of sunshine really go a long way.
Yeah.
Professor Nancy Horowitz, why don't you give us a brief overview of your work? You're a professor of Italian and Jewish studies at Boston University.
Yes, that's right.
And tell us a little bit about the Elie Wiesel Center and about your scholarship and activism and whatever you want to do to give us a picture of who you are and how you serve.
Okay. Let me start with the Elie Wiesel Center. We're a very vibrant interdisciplinary academic center at Boston University. We have about 30 faculty who are affiliated with the center, many of whom offer courses. We offer a minor in Jewish studies. We also offer a minor in Holocaust, genocide, and human rights studies, which began just a couple of years ago, actually. So we do offer a lot of Holocaust programming in Jewish studies writ large, programs that include a lecture series. Actually, I think we have three lecture series at this point, including the new Elie Wiesel Memorial Lecture Series that we're in the middle of right now, actually. The first talk was given by Rabbi Joseph Pollack, who talked about his experiences as a child survivor and his memoir, which is entitled After Auschwitz, The Bells Still Ring. Then we had a talk on Primo Levi just a few days ago. And a little later, we're having a talk on Cambodia to end the series. It really focuses on Elie Wiesel's mission of social justice and human rights. So that's sort of our main programming. We also have a film series on the Holocaust, which took place last spring, and I believe we'll be repeating it next spring, that I was involved with because I teach Holocaust film and Holocaust literature at BU. My own scholarship has been centered on the work of Primo Levi for the last few years, and now also on Elie Wiesel, who's they're really the two best known and greatest figures within Holocaust studies, and I think that their writings have a lot to teach us about today's world as well. And that's what my lecture will be on.
That's marvelous. I couldn't agree more. For listeners who maybe didn't benefit from a certain type of liberal arts education, who didn't have the pleasure of encountering the writings of Elie Wiesel or Primo Levi, could you give a brief thumbnail sketch of these two towering figures, both a little bit of their personal biographies, but as you indicated, the significant role they played in shaping conversations, not only about the Holocaust itself, but also about the implications, the ethics, the moral challenges that would help us think through issues in the contemporary world?
Certainly. Elie Wiesel was born in 1928 in Romania. He was deported as a young teenager in 1944 to Auschwitz. After the war, he went to France, he became a writer, and he became a human rights activist. He served as chairman of the Presidential Commission on the Holocaust that later became the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. And finally, he got the Nobel Prize in Peace in 1986. He's written 57 books, mostly in French and English, including Night, which is his best-known work that talks about the experiences he had as a prisoner in Auschwitz and in Buchenwald. He was a professor of the humanities at Boston University, and we created the Elie Wiesel Center for Jewish Studies in his honor about 15 years ago. Very involved with Jewish causes. He worked on, he campaigned for victims of oppression in places like South Africa, in Nicaragua, Sudan, Bosnia, etc. Publicly condemned the 1915 Armenian genocide, and he remained a very strong defender of human rights during his entire lifetime.
And can you speak a little bit about Primo Levi?
About Wiesel.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, Primo Levi was born in 1919. He was deported to Auschwitz when he was a little bit older than Wiesel. He was about 24. He spent a year there. He came out and he immediately wrote his memoir, which is entitled in English, Survival in Auschwitz, about dehumanization, about what happened to him at the camp. But more than anything, he was interested in talking about the group, the we. He almost never uses the pronoun I in his work. He's really interested in what happened to the entire community, to other prisoners, even to the perpetrators. He talks about that in some of his work. Very interested in the issue of dehumanization and how dehumanization can lead directly to atrocity, which is certainly one of the main messages I think we can get out of his work today.
Absolutely relevant. And, you know, there are disconcerting trends visible around the world, a resurgence of a kind of primordial nationalism, an idea of an us versus them. Certainly some of the language that we have seen throughout the 20th century, as Elie Wiesel rightly and consistently pointed out. And I want to use this opportunity to ask both of you, both Rabbi Bayo and Professor Horowitz, about an interesting challenge, question, if you will. And that is, there are multiple ways of talking about the Holocaust. And one of the questions that is a very high-level question has to do with the uniqueness of this event. either it's treated by some as an absolutely ineffable Jewish experience, horrific in every imaginable way, and unique and somewhat special for the Jewish community. And another angle to talk about the similar set of events would be to say, we need to deal with the human underpinnings of this. I'll give an example here. The Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. very much focuses on the exclusive Jewish nature of this. The Museum of Tolerance in Los Angeles takes a different point of view, which starts with, let's look at racism. Let's look at prejudice. Let's look at the very common expressions of things that can lead to the most horrific forms of genocide. In other words, placing the Holocaust in a much broader framework as something we need to continue to be vigilant for in all the ways it shows up, even in everyday life, in jokes, in slurs, and things of that nature. How do you take something so profoundly impactful as the Jewish experience in 20th century Europe and begin to make those connections? Where do you fall on the question of uniqueness versus universality, if you will? Professor Horowitz?
I have to say I fall very much more in the school of universality. I think it's very important to look at the lessons of the Holocaust and see how they apply to our contemporary world and understand a lot of the connections that are ongoing, that when we look at white nationalism, we look at white terrorism, we look at prejudice of any kind, anti-Semitism, etc., that we really need to see the connections between these events and how they develop. I have to say, also have a lot of understanding of the position that says the Holocaust is a uniquely Jewish event. We have to be careful about not drawing too many analogies or we lose the specific nature of the Holocaust. I actually agree with that too, but I think there's a middle ground possible.
Yeah, very good. Rabbi Bayo, what are your thoughts on this?
So I don't think that there is a dichotomy necessarily. I think that on the grand scheme, when we look at the Holocaust as an historical event, yes, that is uniquely Jewish. But the individual suffering is universal. In this week's Torah portion that many Jews read in the in synagogues, we're going to read about the Tower of Babel, where you have people that speak different languages and different cultures, and then they spread around. But crying and laughing, it's in the same language. We cry all in the same way and we laugh all in the same way. So on the individual level, there is no difference whether I speak English or Italian when I cry or when I laugh. And so I think that on the 30,000 feet perspective of the Holocaust, yes, that is a unique event which has to be taught in a unique way. But on the individual suffering of the individual, of the families, of what they went through, that is a universal message. And that's why, for example, we called our center, the Center for Holocaust Education, and Human Dignity. Because it's about, ultimately, the human dignity, but it's also about, in the grand scheme of the Holocaust, as a unique Jewish experience. And another thing, if I may say, I think it's very important that when we talk about the Holocaust, we don't end with the end of World War II and with the Shoah. There is another part of the Holocaust that is the how the Jewish people were able to create awesome communities around the world despite the Holocaust. We were able to rebuild our nation and we have not turned our backs to the world. We have engaged the world in the most positive way possible, trying to be part of this world, trying to be part of this community, this universal community, trying to help everybody, both ourselves and everybody else. So I think that is a very important lesson from the Holocaust that often we don't talk enough about, of what happened the day after.
And the day after that.
The day after that, right.
One of the ways in which Holocaust studies has informed my scholarship in a previous academic life, I'm no longer in a university setting, but it got me thinking deeply about questions related to trauma in history and questions of memory, personal memory, as well as community memorializations. I wrote a lot about museums. I looked at ways in which we turned experience into story. But it brings me to an issue that I don't know if I ever satisfactorily resolved for myself, and I maybe still haven't due to some of the traumatic things I experienced in working in the Middle East and Africa and in war zones and things of that nature. There's a real question around representation. And this is somewhat of an academic topic, I'm aware. We'll treat it with a light hand here. But the question is, how do you take something that significant, that impacted so many people in so many different ways? Primo Levi, as you said, Professor Horowitz, talked a lot about the dehumanization of the perpetrators of this action as well. So many different threads to this story. How do you take something so outside of normal human experience and find ways to convey it? Obviously, film and literature are very much engaged in this kind of creative expression. But Professor Horowitz, could you talk a little bit about this issue of representation? How do we tell stories both to ourselves and to the world about deeply disturbing and troubling events? How do we find language to somehow carry the weight of that experience?
That's a really, really good question. That's actually exactly what I teach at Boston University. I have taught a course for the last quite a few years on Holocaust literature and film. And one way I actually start this course is to talk about the difference between documentaries and feature films. In documentaries, you get a much harsher reality presented on the screen. You get details that might be very difficult for some audience members, for some students to take. With feature film, you get a softening of historical detail. If you look at Schindler's List, it's really a very good example of this. It was a huge blockbuster. It made a very deep impression on a couple of generations of viewers. And yet there are historical distortions. There's a way in which that story is not very representative of the Holocaust as a whole. It's taking a single German who tried to save Jews and did save Jews and making him the focus rather than the victims of the Holocaust. So there are ways in which you can look at that film and think that it's not very central to representing the Holocaust, but it still had a very positive impact. So it's, I think, important to look at feature film from this particular point of view. Is it teaching anything? Is it teaching distortions, like The Boy in the Striped Pajamas, for example? Is it a film that will give the audience some information and some knowledge about the Holocaust they might not otherwise have? The same is true for literature. If you look at some of the fiction that's out there, The Tattooist of Auschwitz, which has made a huge splash, I actually just finished reading it because I wanted to see what it was about. I know some scholars are disturbed by that book because there are kind of needless historical issues with it, things that are just not right about the story, and yet it's teaching people something. So is it worth that particular representational bet, if you see what I mean, or not? That's the question that comes up.
I mean, and the multifaceted nature of experience and the way in which language, although profoundly formative of our experience, sometimes struggles to communicate the richness of it. Much as you say you fall on the side of the universalists, I fall on the side of the pluralists. I think we need as many different versions of things as possible, bearing in mind, of course, the responsibility of the narrator in shaping cultural conversations. Rabbi Bayo, this is something that even when it comes to your own leadership of the religious community here, you deal with, I'm sure, every day. I'm not deeply familiar with Torah scholarship and things of that nature, but there are questions and commentaries and challenges to those questions. In other words, a living set of practices to even understand the core texts and tenets of your faith. How do you navigate that complexity and at the same time still provide the clarity that believers need? This is an easy question, I'm sure. No, tongue in cheek.
No, definitely not. I think that we have to be honest with our, I try to be honest with my students, whether they are 5 years old or 95 years old, that we don't always have answers. And I think it's very important that just because I'm a rabbi and I'm a teacher and whatever, that does not make me the holder of the truth. And the truth can be found in various different paths and in many different traditions. One of our greatest historical scholars and rabbis was Maimonides. And Maimonides writes, and he says that we have to accept the truth from whoever it comes. So I will start with that. I don't have all the answers.
Well, and I appreciate you putting those two terms into the conversation, because honesty as a guiding principle will lead you to acknowledge moments when we don't know the truth.
Yes,
which is a useful thing. Part of what was in the background of my question a number of years ago in graduate school, I read a book by Richard Bullitt, a historian from Columbia, called Islam, View from the Edge. And his challenge in this book, dealing with the historical Muslim experience, was to decenter this story. So it wasn't just the story of the leaders of the community and the dynasties and the kingdoms and so on, kind of a traditional official history point of view, but really trying to get to the lived experience of folks where conversion to this community of faith led them to ask a lot of questions. How do we do this now? And what about that? Oh, is this okay? And what about that? And his point of view in that book is, I don't know if I'm doing it justice, was that it's in that sight of asking those questions and seeking those answers that we find a different story for that historical tradition, right?
I think that questions are always more important than the answers.
Yes.
And as long as we keep asking questions, maybe someday we'll reach the answers. And I wondered if, with your permission, to reconnect what Professor Horowitz was saying earlier in your question. You know, sometimes I think there isn't only, you know, the question was, how do we transmit the history of the Holocaust, in what way, etc. A few years ago, I had the pleasure of going to Poland with a number of other Jewish leaders from this area. And it was my first time in Poland. And I was raised in a home of Holocaust survivors. And I had been taught that everything about Poland is bad, and all Polish were Nazi collaborators, etc., etc. And so I get to Warsaw, and the first thing I do, I look up on my GPS, where is the JCC in Warsaw? So I go to the JCC in Warsaw, and I have a wonderful conversation with the director there. She tells me that she was born in Poland from Polish parents and grandparents, etc. And she said her family was saved by Polish. And I was like, whoa, that's a part of the story that I did not hear about. And the more I studied that issue, you know, history is complex. The Holocaust is very complex. And there could be different points of view for even the same person at different points in time during the period of the Shoah. You know, we could have an experience of people being helped by Polish people, Jews being helped by Polish people, by German people at one point in time, and then the same ones became collaborators because their family was under threat. And then I started asking myself, how would I have reacted? Would I have saved another human being, putting my own kids in jeopardy or whatever? I can't answer that question. I have no idea, and I don't think that we can answer those questions. We can pause, reflect, and then the question becomes, okay, what are we going to do in order not to repeat those situations?
Yes, I think at some very profound level, the question of how shall we now live together, separately, in community, as individuals and families, as a single species on this planet, something that I think we not we on this in this conversation, but we collectively tend to forget. And so really it comes down to a question of ethics or ethos. How do we navigate? The answer to those questions can't be hypotheticals. They have to be answers that show up in our actions. And, you know, whereas philosophy class can get away with things like, well, imagine a time machine and, you know, kind of crazy hypothetical examples, which can help clarify the stakes in an issue. It's really only when you're placed in a situation and you have to act and not acting is an action that you really understand the complexity. Let's talk a little bit about the new Center for Holocaust Education and Human Dignity. You mentioned the uniqueness of this partnership. Can you talk a little bit about how that came to be? And then let's talk about Professor Horowitz's upcoming lecture. So speak first to the center itself.
Sure. So as part of the East Valley JCC, we created a few years ago the Center for Holocaust Education and Human Dignity. We have been involved with Holocaust education for roughly about 10 years. Today, we're probably the organization in Arizona that is the most involved as far as a breadth of programs in Holocaust education. So we're continuing a long-standing tradition even before my time, before I came to be the CEO of the East Valley JCC. We have many programs during the year. Naturally, we celebrate and commemorate Yom HaShoah like many other organizations. But on top of that, we have exhibits, lectures, workshops, and often, if not always, they are in partnership with the city of Chandler, the Unified School District of Chandler, Chandler Center for the Arts, and many other organizations in town, both Jewish and non-Jewish, in order to teach about the Holocaust, and then to reach the human dignity side of it. Last year, we created a partnership with, a long-standing partnership with the Los Angeles Museum of the Holocaust. And my thought was, okay, what other organizations that are the premier organizations in their field exist in America that we can partner with to be able to bring their expertise, their speakers, their exhibits to Arizona? So the Los Angeles Museum of the Holocaust was one. And naturally, for me, because of my past work experience at Boston University, was also to contact the Elie Wiesel Center and Professor Zenk and then Professor Horowitz and say, okay, can we convince you to have this partnership with us? And naturally, thank God, I'm very glad to say that the partnership is starting, and this hopefully will be a long-standing partnership to bring the expertise of Boston University, which is one of the premier universities in America, and of the Elie Wiesel Center with all of their faculty and expertise. We also we are in the process of creating a partnership with the Museum of Jewish Heritage in New York City. And so this is a trend that we will continue to expand so that we as East Valley JCC, I am not a museum person, but I can partner with museums and Center of Holocaust Education around the country and bring them here. And that is the process.
Yeah. Professor Horowitz, give us a preview of the lecture that you'll be delivering on November 18. At the East Valley Jewish Community Center.
At the Chandler Center for the Arts.
I'm sorry, the venue is the Chandler Center for the Arts.
Exactly, 6 p.m. on November 18.
Okay, good. Give us a brief overview of the topic. The title of your lecture, at least the one I have here, is Elie Wiesel and Primo Levi, The Gray Zone of Holocaust Survival. What are you going to be addressing in this talk?
I'm going to be talking primarily about the identity of the Holocaust survivor in these two figures, the way in which they talk about it in very different ways, but still have quite a few points of comparison. I'm going to start by talking about Elie Wiesel's essay. Actually, it's a book called Legends of Our Times. It's an introduction in which Wiesel talks about going to Jerusalem, meeting a rabbi who knew his family very well and was rather scandalized that Wiesel didn't become a rabbi himself, because that was the tradition of the family. And the rabbi asks him questions about the kind of writing that Wiesel does. He wants to know, this rabbi wants to know, if he's telling the truth or is he writing lies, which is what the rabbi understands fiction to be. So he says, I'm just going to read you a little quote from this. So you tell stories about things that happened? Yes, he answers, yes being Wiesel, about things that happened or could have happened. But they did not? No, not all of them did. In fact, some were invented from almost the beginning to the end. Some events do take place but are not true. Others are, although they never occurred. That's the end of this quote from the introduction. He's making a really powerful argument for what we might call truthful fiction, which is a category he explored in a lot of his own work and a lot of the novels that he wrote. And it's a kind of guidance that I've used for my students and for my own work in which we think about what representation means. Is fictive representation as good as testimony, for example? Can it make a point or not? Can it teach the reader the facts and pull the reader into the story rather than just entertain, for example? Does it further the reader's knowledge of the Holocaust? So his deep thought on this, I think, is really compelling and really gets back to your question about representation and how representation of the Holocaust or any genocide, any traumatic event can take place. What kind of language do we have to express that trauma in? So I'll be starting by talking a little bit about Wiesel and this introduction to Legends of Our Times. And then I'm going to read a poem by Primo Levi called The Survivor, in which he talks about, in very, very harsh terms, what it's like to be a survivor. What does it mean? Is he turning his face? Is he turning his back on all of the people who didn't make it? What kind of guilt, what kind of survivor shame is embedded in the figure of the poem? And I'll be looking at how these two can relate to each other, at the differences between the two writers, because they're significant, but also what they have in common. That's basically what the talk will be on.
In an era where political language has grown coarser around the world, not only here in the United States, but especially here in the United States, also in regimes in Central South America, also in Southeast Asia, also, of course, in Europe and the UK, some of the nuance of these discussions is lost, if it was ever there to begin with. I'm not sure. Why is it important for people to engage in the intellectual, cultural, historical effort that you're inviting them to participate in, whether through this lecture or through your teaching? Why should folks today in 2019 be grappling with some of the writing and some of these issues from an earlier period?
Because I think a lot of the issues are really the same. How does dehumanization work? What happens when one group marginalizes another and dehumanizes them? What happens to that second group? Do they keep their civil and civic rights or not? What kind of danger are they put in? If you look at some of the conversations that are going on today about immigration, I think we see this in the way in which people are being talked about. So the language itself can be very, very important. And reading about the Holocaust, reading Holocaust testimony, thinking about the ways in which some of these debates are being articulated helps us understand what's happening today as well.
Socrates, of course, written by Plato, famously said, "The unexamined life is not worth living." I think one of my greatest fears, as I see both older and younger folks not asking provocative questions that lead them to search their own experience for answers. You know, there's an increasing reliance on established narratives that are adopted unquestioningly. I can't think of a more frightening thing as someone who loves the life of the mind and ethical practice and things of that nature, that we're ending up with a consumption-oriented cultural conversation rather than one where people need to engage and think for themselves. I mean, education, when done right, is disruptive and transformational. Education, when it's delivering an established fixed product in an industrialized manner, which you're hearing a little of my I'll try not to get in a soapbox here, leads to something I think very dangerous. And of course, I'm speaking of earlier childhood education, obviously by the university, although universities are not free from their struggles with this, I'm well aware. Rabbi, you opened this conversation by talking about the early childhood education program at the East Valley Jewish Community Center and the joy that you see with the young people in the rooms and so on. Obviously, the topic of the Holocaust is a difficult one for adults. Is it even appropriate to begin discussing some of these things with children? How do you handle that that question?
That's a very good question because I ask myself this question because of my own kids. I have two kids, 11 and 9. So the question is, at what age is it appropriate to start talking to them about the Holocaust and how far to go? And I think definitely that we have an obligation to teach, but I think we have to be careful at what age. I don't know what is the right age in general for every kid. Every kid is a little bit different. I know that with my kids, we started around the age of 9, 10, 8, but around that time, to just let them know that, you know, and you can say there was a Holocaust, a lot of people died, a lot of people were killed, without going into the graphics of it, into the details, the morbid details of it. And as they grow, they can learn more. I was recently in New York with my family, and we did go to see a Holocaust exhibit with both of them. And they were okay. They were fine. You know, it was not too morbid, and it was okay. But they know about the Holocaust, and I hope that they will choose to learn more about it as they grow.
You know, you raised such an important point, and it's, of course, the Holocaust, and not only the Holocaust, that are difficult subjects to broach. Here in Phoenix is the Heard Museum, which has a fabulous collection from tribes throughout the Southwest. And as I was taking my boys, who are 5 and 7, to visit the museum, I realized as we were walking in, I've not created a context for them to understand who are the people whose material culture is represented here. I was just, you know, parenting and chaos, and it's all about snacks, and do we have the sippy cups, and, you know, get in the car and, like, go to the thing. And all of a sudden I realized, wait a minute, I'm a cultural anthropologist. I'm deeply passionate about these issues. I'm committed to social justice. I'm trying to raise two young white males that will be part of the solution, not part of the problem. And we're walking into this place, and it was in the summer, so it was like 112 outside. And I thought, we have to stop even out here in this heat and just have a conversation. What are we going to see? And so, you know, it's, I'm not sure, by the way, that I created the best narrative for it, but it was, which we won't rehash here, that's not the point, but to begin to deal with these challenging, difficult aspects of our shared human experience, not all of which challenges were shared, but the fact that our humanity is what's called into question makes them something that touches all of us. Professor Nancy Horowitz, as we wrap up this conversation, are there any other comments or themes or questions or challenges you wish to pose here? Anything else that we should collectively be thinking about as we...
Well, actually, I'd like to get back to our conversation from before, if you don't mind. One point that I wanted to make about whether or not the Holocaust is a unique event versus universality. Even if we talk about the Holocaust as a unique Jewish event, because the Jews were, after all, the major focus of genocide, we need to remember all the other victims. There were another 5 million victims, after all. Homosexuals, the Roma and the Sinti, Catholic priests, for example. There were a lot of other people that were caught up in the net of the Holocaust besides Jews. And it's important to commemorate all of them, in my view.
Yes.
Yes, thank you for that. It's again, it's an important thing. I think it's easier not to look, right? It's easier to...
Yes.
To retreat into a kind of narrow view, you know, those things happen, they happen to us. I mean, whether you're doing this from the inside or the outside or adjacent in some way, these are complex issues, and I think they touch all of us. You know, I can only think, connecting it back to something we talk about more frequently on this program, in every large company, in every large organization, of course you have, as in any community, a multiplicity of viewpoints and perspectives, personal histories, stories of persecution and survival and victory in the face of of persecution. You know, just this is a richly human issue. And I'm very pleased you're bringing this depth and level of expertise on one part of that conversation to the Valley. Rabbi Michael Bayo, is there anything that you want to add, other issues or thoughts you want to share as we wrap up this conversation?
Well, first of all, thank you very much again for having us here and to be able to talk about the East Valley J and specifically about the upcoming lecture with Professor Horowitz. I think ultimately we are here for a very finite time, each one of us. And we need to be using our time. We have a choice in front of us to either do something good or be passive and not do anything. And I think that is lectures like this and programs like this and opportunities to reach out in the community like this that hopefully will spark the interest of more people to be part of the solution, as you said, for your kids and hopefully for my kids as well, to be part of the solution and to find ultimately that we all, as I said earlier, we all cry the same and we all laugh the same. And as I said last night to some friends, I said, this is the beauty of the East Valley JCC, that we have people with all kinds of backgrounds, but here we create moments that we can cry together and we can laugh together.
Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful way to end this conversation. Rabbi Michael Bayo from the East Valley Jewish Community Center, Professor Nancy Horowitz, professor at Boston University. Thank you both for the work you're doing, serving both your specific communities and the broader community of humanity. And
yeah, I just would like to remind that the lecture will be on November 18, 6 p.m. at the Chandler Center for the Arts, and the tickets can be purchased at evjcc.org.
Perfect, and we'll link to that here in the description as well. Thank you both for joining us, and thank you for sharing your insights and your thoughts on this important issue.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
For all of us here at Business Radio X, this is Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and we'll see you next time on Valley Business Radio.